enormous catch-all, an umbrella, and I'm going to start off with some things, and you just interrupt. In 1947, the 50 largest manufacturing corporations in the United States produced 17% of the total value added in manufacturing. In other words, think of it this way, the total value of manufactured goods, that doesn't include agricultural goods, doesn't include constructed stuff like houses, you know, it doesn't include services, but the total value of manufactured goods, 17% of that was produced by just 50 corporations in 1947. 20 years later, in 1967, the 50 largest manufacturing corporations produced 25%, one quarter of the total value added in manufacturing. Now I want to ask you a question. So what? Does that make any difference? I hope that you saw that's big business. I could have cited all sorts of other figures about that the top 50 corporations own so many billions of dollars worth or employ such and such a percentage of the labor force. And, you know, there are all kinds of figures that you can quote and that are frequently cited like that. But I want to ask you right now, does that alarm you? Does that bother you? Does that bother you? Okay. Anybody else think about it? I mean, that just 50 corporations produce 25% of the total value of manufactured goods. And I'd like to see if it does bother you at least a little bit, if you're alarmed about that. You know, and in 20 years it went from 17% to 25%. And if you are somewhat alarmed by that, you know, not that you're ready to run out and overturn the filthy, decadent capitalist system. I'm not, you know, but you're just slightly alarmed. I'd like to sort of see evidence of a nod. Because I want to see how many people are alarmed. Not too many.
Well, can I ask you something?
Yeah.
The same 50, sorry, 17% that went to the 25%.
Mm-hmm. No, there was some change in that number. A lot of them remained the same. Most of them remained the same. They were still in there, but especially down toward the bottom of the list. Some dropped out, a few new ones came in.
What percent remains there?
Oh, I don't know. I could look it up. If you're interested in who remains there, look at Fortune every year around August, July or August, it comes out with data on this. Now, they wouldn't have those particular numbers that I just cited. I want to ask you, I don't know your name, but why are you alarmed?
I'm Dan Foe, and my father is a furniture manufacturer, small business. And I've seen a lot of the force of that pull on him, seeing that he has about 300 people working for him, as a large manufacturing company that owns a tremendous amount of companies, like F&H, Green Champ, Sony, not just F&H, Green Champ. They own many, and have Cosville. This is owned by something else, and I've seen the pressure that has been put upon him. It's becoming harder and harder.
What are those pressures?
Start their own business.
Yeah. What are those pressures?
Just selling, because if they can sell by carloads and carloads and carloads and make a whole thing, where are small manufacturers that have to stop for maybe half a truck, carloads and the prices and shipping.
So they can sell at lower prices. So he has trouble competing.
Mm-hmm.
Does the user of furniture, and we're all users of furniture, benefit from this?
At the lower price?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, but you're alarmed because this is the threat to small business fear. And that's true, that big business is often a threat to small business. That may be a truism. See, if a business is big because it has been efficient, if you grow big by being efficient, beating out your competitors, And of course, you're a threat to competitors. You're more efficient.
But your quality might not be as good.
Well, that's up to the customer to decide, isn't it? If your quality is no good, presumably, even though your price is low, you won't be able to sell too much. You mean you think that maybe these
sometimes
big...
Sometimes people will buy cheaper quality things that are one of them that they're
sometimes people are deceived.
Yeah.
Are people, okay, are people more deceived by large corporations or small corporations?
I think it makes a difference.
I think it does. Anybody else got any views on this? I think that small businesses engage in more deception, fraud, slippery practice, and irresponsible behavior than large by a long shot. Anybody feel differently?
Could you give us an example of that to get my thinking in gear with you here?
Well, I just think I'm more likely to be cheated by a small businessman than a large. Why? Because the big business has to be very, very concerned about public relations. And the small business can often be a fly-by-night operation. In other words, I am more concerned that the guy who sells me my automobile, the car dealer, who's a small businessman, I'm more concerned that he will cheat me than that General Motors will cheat me. You're not. Well, you're not. Okay, I feel that one of my protections against being cheated is the fact that that firm will be around and has a lot of other customers to whom it wants to sell and is very concerned about bad press and bad publicity. Now, I don't want to give the impression that small businessmen are dishonest. I think the best protection, generally I would say this, the best protection against being gypped is your knowledge that that person who sold to you plans to be around tomorrow. And one piece of evidence that he plans to be around tomorrow is he's been around for a long time. So you tend to have more confidence in a firm that's been around for a long time. Because you think it'll continue to be around for a long time and it'll want to continue selling. You know, for most of the products we buy, we just have no way of independently checking their quality. So many things, I mean, even a chair like this, I can't. You know, I'm a complete dummy when it comes to buying most things. So I buy largely by brand name. I buy by reputation of the producer. And I know the reputations of large firms. I don't know the reputation of most small firms, and I'm somewhat more skeptical when I purchase the products of small firms.
Okay.
All right, we all have different experiences. Of course, we all behave in different ways, and sometimes we do things for silly reasons, too. You know, I don't buy Pepsi-Cola at all because I don't like their advertisements. They just offend me, so I never don't allow Pepsi-Cola in the house. The kids sneak it in. But some people rely on consumer reports, and other people think that consumer reports often are misleading, not intentionally, but... You know, if they have a limited sample of the wares and...
What you said about big business before, I think can hold true an awful lot with small business too in a smaller sized town because they depend so much upon their reputation. If you had, like in my husband's case, hardware store on one end of the town and hardware store on the other end, if you can't deal honestly with the people, and if you can't keep your reputation, you know, in a positive attitude, you know you're going to lose business.
Right.
So in that case, their honesty and their reputation is pretty important.
Yeah, sure. Where the reputation, where you have reason to believe that the reputation of the seller is very, very important to him, you have reason to have confidence in the quality of the product. Now, what I was suggesting is that for products that are sold to you by firms at some distance, where you have no knowledge of the firm, it helps, well, where it's sold by firm at some distance. If you do have knowledge of the firm because it's been around a long time, you've seen it in Fortune 500, many people will have more confidence in it. But I want to go on. I'm trying to get out some of the reasons why big business is a concern to people.
I think it distributes the wealth to fewer people.
How do you mean that? Well, okay, now you said two things there, wealth and control. Well, who gets the... a large corporation like General Motors, it generates a huge amount of income. It pays that out to suppliers, employees, production line employees, unionized employees, to middle management people, to top executives, to shareholders, to the government in the form of taxes, all kinds of governments in the form of all kinds of taxes. Now, who gets the wealth that you're talking about? Are you talking about what goes to the shareholders?
I'm not talking about the shareholders that have this occasional share, but I'm closing the big block of shares. And seeing that I'm quite interested in the full field, I'm assuming, and I've heard that the same stockholders are in touch with the big business. And so that would limit the number of people that are involved in policy setting.
Okay, well, now you're getting into the question of control. I want to deal with that, but that's separate from the question of wealth. I'm trying to figure out whether you're saying that large corporations are channeling an unfair amount of wealth to a few people. Is that what you're saying? So that's one of the bad consequences of big business, that a few people, big business enables a few people to get huge chunks of wealth that are really undeserved. Is that what you're saying?
Well, if it's undeserved, I don't know whether I would say undeserved.
Well, it's certainly true that a person who owns 1,000 shares of General Motors stock gets a nice chunk of wealth regularly. And if you own 500,000 shares, you get even more. But notice, you don't have to own a chunk of big corporations to be enormously wealthy. A lot of very, very wealthy people own nominal amounts of large corporations who don't own any at all. People get wealthy in all sorts of ways, corporations. And this is a question of control. Who controls these large corporations? A.A. Burley, who died a couple years ago, was spending much of his career writing about the problem of who controlled the large corporations and what he called the separation between ownership and control. He wasn't worried that the owners were getting too much. He was worried that the controllers, the managers, were getting too much. He called the management of large publicly held corporations, he called them an automatic self-perpetuating oligarchy. You know, do the shareholders of General Motors control General Motors? Not really. And it seemed to him, as it seems to many people, that these people are essentially responsible to nobody. Consequently, this is one of the big fears, one of the major fears of people who have studied large corporations. That large corporations have evolved an elite, a managerial elite, with an enormous amount of power for which they are answerable to no one but themselves. Do you see the logic of it? You see, if you owned a corporation, you would be subject to the test of profitability. You know, if you did not buy low-cost inputs, if you didn't buy the best machines, if you didn't sell at the best price, if you didn't vary your product in order to meet consumer tastes and preferences, you'd lose income. Your profits would go down and you'd hurt. And so that's what provides you an incentive to be efficient, you know, to economize, to run a good business, to pay attention to the tastes and preferences of consumers, to pay attention to the preferences of workers and so on. It's the interest in your own profits. But when you don't live off the profits, when the profits go to the shareholders, and the shareholders really can't control you because they're too split up, you know, all over the place, they can't get together and throw you out. They don't even know whether you're doing a good job. What you're doing is so complicated, and they have so little knowledge of it, so little time to spend investigating what you're doing, that the shareholders are rather powerless, then you're in a not rather neat position. You can be inefficient and lazy. So you can just sit around in your office and drink martinis all afternoon and get away with it. Telephone company, all right? The telephone company is under regulation. Telephone company can't hiccup without permission from some regulatory board. So let's lay that one. Mm-hmm. Okay, try another one.
In Minnesota, this was 2 years ago, there were over 200 independent companies that were, they're small, but they were in competition with Bell Telephone. And there is competition, and some people are getting disillusioned with telephone companies operated, we call them PBX systems, and
so they're going to these smaller firms that specialize, and so they put in their own system, and they own the whole system rather than pay a service.
You're pointing out something important that we couldn't get into, that actually the telephone company does suffer from competition. But I didn't want to have to get, but I'm glad you brought that up. But I wanted to take the easy way out here and say, well, you know, rather than point out the telephone companies face competition, just as electric utilities face competition from gas utilities, and even if they're together, like they are in Minnesota, I think, they face competition from utilities in other areas. Why do you think these utilities advertise, come locate in the Mid-South, a growing region? They're trying to get additional customers to move in, large industrial users who will make the difference between profit and loss for these. But generally, the clearest examples or the closest approximations to firms that don't have to worry about competition, though they still do have to worry, are public utilities like telephone companies and water companies if they're privately owned, and electric and gas utilities. But they are regulated. So can we shift now to something that isn't regulated?
Yeah. I
don't know the company well enough to kind of, what do they produce?
Oscilloscope.
If I knew what you did with an oscilloscope, I could say something and tell. What do you do with it?
They got about 5% of the market. Don't they?
Yeah, they have competition. They just build a better product.
If you produce only 75%, that means there's 25% you don't produce, and that's a lot, because that could grow to 26% and 28%, and probably if you have 75% of the market and it falls to 72%, I suspect that you're going to have a loss that year, a decline from 75 to 72. Remember, when you're selling 75% of the product, that's not all gravy. That means you're also producing 75% of the product, which means you're hiring 75% of the labor, buying 75% of the chromium, or whatever you stick in an oscilloscope. What's the matter? Good management in there. The earnings would be higher. Tell you what I'm going to do. He gets together a little syndicate, and there are people who've been specializing in this, and he makes an offer to shareholders, in which the shareholders can't resist. He offers to buy that stock at something above the going price, and he quickly grabs up a big chunk of the stock. Why does he do that? Because he figures he's going to be able to take over the management, throw out these inefficient managers, put in his own managers. The corporation will then be run efficiently. The expected value of future earnings will rise, and he'll make a profit. And there are a whole raft of people who specialize in that. Conglomerates kind of specialize in doing that. And corporation executives tremble in fear of the Raiders. They know, now, and this is very important, they know that if they're not operating it just as efficiently as possible, and somebody else discovers that, that makes them a target for a raid. And the stakes are high, because if these guys take the corporation over, you are out on your fanny. And you're probably pulling down $125,000 a year, plus all sorts of fringe benefits. And that provides you with a powerful incentive. These are some of the restraints on managers. I could go on and multiply. There are others, but I think that's enough for that. I want to get on to something. Yeah?
How did then the problem like this block you
Well, how did the problem develop? They made, the management of Lockheed made a series of mistakes, very serious mistakes. One thing they did was they relied upon Rolls-Royce. Now, Rolls-Royce is a good corporation to rely on, ordinarily, because Rolls-Royce, until very recently, had the reputation of being one of the most extraordinarily well-managed companies in the world. But Rolls-Royce made a mistake. They made a mistake of trusting the British government. And governments are somewhat unreliable. You know, the government is more fickle than customers. You know, an individual customer is very fickle, but customers in the aggregate are not that fickle. The General Dynamics took an enormous loss. I'm not sure, but the guys managing Lockheed, gets them gold stars for being successful in persuading the government to bail them out. They were good managers. Now, it may have been contrary to the public interest, and we maybe should have rooted against them, but from the standpoint of the owners of Lockheed, they were shrewd and good managers. When General Dynamics took something like a $450 million loss some years back, the automatic self-perpetuating oligarchy ceased to be automatically self-perpetuating. They went. And the number of corporations which have taken unexpected loss, or even whose profits have declined precipitately, the managers have been thrown out. So they are subject to control. How about, it came up yesterday, how about the argument that large corporations must be feared because they control American foreign policy and they get us into all sorts of ventures where we ought not to be involved?
You mean like ITT? Didn't they get them, the presidents of that organization, get caught in the chili deal down here? Wasn't he criticized for that pretty tough?
Mm-hmm.
The gentleman was making $800,000 a year plus fringe benefits.
Yeah.
You're talking about wealth, about $800,000 a year.
That kind of grabs me a little, yeah.
He got worked out pretty heavy with chili, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. Yeah. Is that to alarm you?
Oh, I think this goes on all the time. It doesn't alarm me or doesn't even particularly surprise me. I mean, they're in deep with all these sort of things. You can't just expect them to stay back and be oblivious to these sort of things. That's the thing that kind of made me wonder about when you said about Public Utilities Commission, like that ITT thing. You say, heavens, they're regulated by PUC. Well, wouldn't if you and I, suppose you and I were running the thing, what would be our first thing? Wouldn't it be to see if we couldn't get to the politicians for the next appointment for the PUC to be sure that he's one of our boys?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if we didn't, I think we're pretty much pretty sleepy then, aren't we?
Okay, so you're suggesting that maybe regulatory commissions don't work too well.
I know if I was running ITT, the first thing I'd want to do would be to get my man on it. I mean, if I'm that naive,
Wait. Let's get to IT. You keep talking about ITT and the Public Utility Commission.
Okay,
ITT doesn't run telephone.
Well, I was kind of having PG&E, and we have a thing down there about setting rates, you know?
Wait a minute, this is beginning to sound like a government bureaucracy here. PG&E is what? Pacific Gas and Electric? Well, but looking to the future for oil, the proven reserves, oil reserves, are in the Middle East. And it seems to me that though our government's policy has been somewhat influenced by concern for oil, that it has not been significantly influenced. You know, I don't know. I mean, here your opinions are as valid as mine. It's not a question of economics at all. The United States has supported Israel. It seems to me that if our policy, our foreign policy, were shaped by oil companies, we would not support Israel. The oil industry. We sometimes think that the whole oil industry wants oil import quotas. And that's not true. Standard Oil of New Jersey, for example, it has a smaller share of the United States market than it has of the world market. Standard Oil of New Jersey likes high oil import quotas because Standard of New Jersey owns a lot of foreign oil that would like to import into the United States. And if you look at the politics of oil in this country, it has been, it has largely supported domestic producers. It's been concerned with keeping up the price of domestic oil by often keeping out foreign oil. And many of the largest oil companies, Royal Dutch Shell and Standard of New Jersey, are very much interested in getting more oil in from abroad. I don't think they've had much voice in government council. Chrome is another example. I mentioned chrome. It's not in an oscilloscope, but chrome is used on some things. I suppose the most essential use is on bicycle handlebars. I'm not sure. chromium or something. I don't know if chromium is connected with chrome, is it? Anyway, there's something that they get out of the ground down in Rhodesia. Okay, is very important to American industrial processes. And I do think that the United States policy with respect to Rhodesia has been shaped, well, I know this, it has been shaped by our concern for that chromium. We have not participated with any vigor or even honesty in United Nations attempts to boycott Rhodesia. What we've done is
we've imposed, we've said we'll participate in the boycott except for those items deemed essential to the United States' vital interests. And the government has winked at and connived in the circumvention of these rules. Here's a case. But what I'm suggesting is you've got to go case by case on this. I don't think, if some of you are looking for grand conclusions out of all of this, I think you've already begun to see you're not going to get any grand conclusions from me. Big business is a broad topic, you know, all kinds of questions, and nobody has all the information. I'm suggesting that you got to go at this piece by piece. With respect to the overall question of, say, this is the question of U.S. involvement in Southeast Asia. The involvement of the United States in Southeast Asia has been contrary to the interests of many corporations. It has meant higher taxes, for one thing, which they don't like. It has meant that the sons, even, of a few corporation executives have to go to war, which